We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
Well, now, if you were not turned off by the meaningless memorization of dates from the great study of history, then you will have discovered that history is a very important and worthwhile activity. For history and its study is something by which we learn to understand ourselves and each other, where we've come from, how we've got to be here, why we do it the way we do it. They're all considerations that we learn about from history, not just as a community or a society, but as individuals as well. One of the ways in which I can understand myself is to understand my own history. I can understand myself in terms of the relationships I have with God or with neighbours, or I could say I can understand myself from my geography. I'm an Australian. But one of the ways in which I learn to understand myself is from my history, that my forebears came out here and we've been living here for X number of generations, and that's why I've got the strong Australian accent that I've got, and my father came from such a working class background, that's why I've got the particular attitudes of life that I've got to some extent. And there's a whole range of historical antecedents to me that help me understand me as to why I am, who I am, what I'm doing, where I'm at now. Within Judaism and Christianity, there is a great concern about history for a variety of reasons. But unlike other religions, historical events play an enormous importance to our understandings, because our faith is rooted in what has happened here in this world, but at another time. And in history, we claim to find the key to the meaning of life itself. That because certain things happen to certain people at certain times, we can understand what life's about, where we're going, what is the plan and purpose in life, what are God's dealings in life, what I should be doing. So in Isaiah 51, you needn't look it up, but it's actually wrong on the notes there, it's Isaiah 54 on the notes, but it's Isaiah 51, verses 1 to 3, God recalls the Israelites to say, look, you who want to be righteous, go back and look at Abraham. Look what I did in his day and see what I can do today. It's a common theme within the scriptures to look back to our beginnings. Look back to the rock from which we were hewn, is the phrase that's used there in Isaiah. Now we know of the history of Abraham in the scriptures. He was a figure of the Middle Eastern period of time around about 2000 to 1500 BC, in that era of time. We know a lot of that period of time from the archaeological discoveries of this century in particular. We have been able to build up quite a picture of the lifestyle of people in that period of time and in that place in the world. And we know that the picture we have in the Bible of the life of Abraham is thoroughly consistent with the lifestyle of the people at that time. The way they did things, the names, the languages they used, a whole range of things show that the picture of Abraham we have in Genesis is thoroughly consistent with the backdrop of the ancient world. Although we find Abraham referred to nowhere else except in the Bible. For he was a nobody, in fact, as far as the ancient world was concerned. He was an insignificant tent dweller. Yet, within the stories of Genesis itself, we see a history which has overwhelming plausibility to it. If you sat down to write out the traditions of your family, especially the religious foundations of your family, I would suggest you would be hard-pressed to write up the story of such an insignificant nobody who had such unpleasant characteristics. That is the stuff that comes of reality not a fiction. He is recorded, warts and all, and some of the warts are very unpleasant blemishes. He passes off his sister, his wife rather, as his sister, a couple of times. She winds up as the concubine of a king, so as to save his neck. That doesn't sound to me a very brave act. I'm sure Sarah didn't enjoy it all that much. It got the king into considerable difficulty. Yet that was his style of life. An unpleasant man is Abraham. Be thankful you're not married to him. Or again, the Egyptian king to whom he passes her off on one occasion turns out to be more noble and godly than he is. Now, when you remember the history of the Israelites and that the Egyptians were their great arch enemies on many occasions, and indeed the very symbol of all that is evil, for the Pharaoh to turn out to be more religious and godly than the founder of their own religious society could only come from reality and not from fiction. You check out the fictionalized stories of Abraham, such as you find in some Islamic writings, and you will find there is nothing wrong with Abraham. He is a great man of God who only ever does godly things. You read the Bible account and you know you're not dealing with fiction, you're dealing with a real character, a real personality, but a nobody. And that in itself is an extraordinary thing. Not a king, not a great one who struts the earth, not a mythical semi-god, just a bloke who lived in the tents, amongst thousands of other people who lived in tents, and who used asses as his main form of transport, it would seem. Well then, why go back to Abraham? What is the importance of him, his history? Well, there are lots of reasons. He is an extraordinary man. Three of the world's great religions claim him as their ancestor. The Islamic faith, Judaism, Christianity. I mean, that knocks out a lot of people in this world, doesn't it? All claim to be the true descendants of Abraham, the real descendants of Abraham, and all say that the others aren't. There is a man who in his own lifetime is a nobody, whom no one records except in the records of the scriptures here, but who is insignificant in this world, but who for centuries later, millions of people on every continent of the world claim him to be their father, and even have gone to war over the subject. He is a man who divides humanity, this nobody. And what is even more extraordinary is that God promised him that would be the case. For those of us who are Christians, it's very important to study Abraham. Because the study of Abraham gives us a perspective on God's great plans for the world. For the whole story of the Bible kicks off in chapter 12 of Genesis on a new route. Chapters 1 to 11 deals with God's dealing with mankind as a whole, but in chapter 12 he picks on one particular fellow, this Abraham, and he starts in process a plan by which he is going to bring the whole world back together again, going to clear up the mess that was created back in the Eden situation. Abraham is a key to the understanding of God's purposes for the universe and therefore his purposes for us. It actually gives us perspective on where the whole world is going and where I should be going. And strangely, it gives us particular perspective about evangelism. Now, the next 3 weeks as we study Abraham are not going to be easy work. Sometimes sermons aren't easy work. That's the way of life, and you'll have to learn about it. I'm sorry, the hardest bit is the chair, but that also is the way of life. It's always a good rush to get in here early on Sunday nights and reach the green ones. But they're going to be hard because they're not the kind of sermons, as Abraham is not the kind of man, whereby I'm going to say, this is what Abraham did, make sure you do that. So whenever you see a Pharaoh, don't give your wife to him as your sister, because Abraham did that and he had bad consequences. That is not the style of sermon that's going to come in the next 3 weeks. But rather, they're going to be perspective changing, I hope. We're going to actually set our minds, I hope, to the whole question of what is God's plan with the world? What was God doing with Abraham and how does it affect us? Where is he taking his people then and today? And it's as we understand the great purposes of God, stretching from 2000 BC up to 2000 AD, as we understand this vast sweep of history, we start to see our own selves in the jigsaw puzzle of the universe properly. We see where this little bit fits into the overall scheme. It all kicks off in chapter 12, verses 1 to 3 of Genesis. Here is the topic sentence of the whole Bible, and therefore a very important passage in the Scriptures. Hands up those who have learnt these as memory verses. Well, feel free, you can be amongst friends. Now that's a very sad thing, you see. Isn't that extraordinary? Hands up those who have ever learnt a memory verse. Good. Hands up those who haven't got hands. Very enthusiastic audience here this evening. Now, lots of us learn memory verses, right? And none of us have learnt, that I could see anyway, I'm sorry if you didn't put your hand up far enough, none of us have learnt the topic sentence of the Bible. What does that tell us about our Bible reading? Or our choice of memory verses? Something very rad, unless of course I'm totally wrong, it's not the topic sentence of the Bible, but you'll hear it, I'm sure you'll see it is. There are almost no three verses in the Bible more important than Genesis 12, 1 to 3. When you read Genesis 12, 1 to 3, you can close your Bibles up and throw them away because you know everything that's going to be said from there on in. Provided you know what the rest is about, of course. Because God in embryo has here created what the whole Bible message is. This is it. This is the fetus. This is the embryo. This is what it's all about. From here on in, everything else is just going to develop as that particular combination of cells, in some senses, has predetermined. But if you rightly understand what God meant when he said those few verses, you will understand what the rest of the Bible is about. Do you think I've repeated that several times? Yes. Do you think I have repeated it intentionally several times? Yes. Do you think it's because I'm trying to say these are important verses? I hope so, because these really are critical. In it you find that God makes promises, he makes contract with this man Abraham, chooses him, and says to him, leave your country and go to the land I'll show you. And I'm going to make you a great nation. And I'm going to make you a blessing to all the nations. Three things are promised there. That God will give him a land. That God will give him a people. That God will make him a blessing. In chapter 12, verse 7, the land is spelt out more specifically as being Canaan. For when he arrives in Canaan, the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, to your offspring I will give this land. And so he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. And this land is given not only to Abraham, but to his people. He is going to become a great nation. He is going to have many descendants. To this childless old man, for that is what he was at this stage, to this childless old man is promised many descendants, the great blessing of God. But the blessing is not only to Abraham. So great will his name become that he's going to become a blessing, or his nation, his family is going to become a blessing, to others as well. Whoever blesses Abraham will be blessed by God, and whoever curses Abraham will be cursed by God. And through Abraham and his descendants, all the nations will be blessed, or will bless themselves, depending on the translation you get. Here are the three promises of God to Abraham. It's easy to overlook them. It's easy to churn on through saying, oh yeah, well I've got that bit, I'll go on. But stop, friends. This is what the whole Bible is about. Those three promises that God makes, that he takes the rest of the Bible to fulfill. They are the three promises. That is the topic sentence that governs what the rest of the Bible is about. The promise of the land, the people, and a blessing. Now, to those of you who are new to the things of God, can I point out to you the extraordinary thing that takes place here? Here is a semi-nomadic nobody whom no one records except his descendants. They don't even know he existed. I never expect to find a tombstone of Abraham. If he did, well and good. I believe it's there somewhere. but I never expected to be found, really, because he was a nobody, who only has one real claim to fame. God promised him that for all generations he would have a land, that his family would become a great nation, and through his family all the nations of the world would be blessed. In one of the readings tonight, we had a whole long list of nations read to us, didn't we? I think it was the end of chapter 15, wasn't it? The Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephaites, Ramarites, yeah, all themites, right? They sound fairy book story to us, Girgashites. Can you imagine a game of football between the Girgashites and the Jebusites sometime? Come on, Girgashites, come on. It just doesn't go, does it? We know from archaeology there's no fairy story. They were real peoples living in that world at that time. But they don't exist now. They had kings, mighty men. They had wealth. They had prosperity. They had importance. They don't exist now. No one knows about them. And when they're read out aloud in church, people think, I wonder who all those people were. And they hope like mad that no one's going to ask them to read those verses. Abraham was a nobody. He didn't have a people. In fact, he was childless for most of this period of time. All he had was the promise of God. And yet people today on seven continents, in the centuries that have followed down from him in every century, all over the world of every race and nation, now want to say that Abraham was my father. And you know the funny thing? That's what God said would happen. Right back in Genesis chapter 12. Those of you who are new to the things of God, you might like to ponder the way in which God works. For it is quite extraordinary. The contract that God established with Abraham is negotiated throughout his life over the next 30, 40 years. It is repeated several times in the book of Genesis. It's enacted or covenanted, really. It is signified or confirmed. It's reiterated throughout these chapters. When it's repeated, we find more details being spelt out, bit by bit, as that's what the Bible does throughout. It just spells out more and more details of the contract God's made with Abraham. So in chapter 12, verse 7, we find out which land it is that God promises. Look at chapter 13, verse 14. We won't look at them all, but look at this one. For here we find just a few more details about the people. He's just separated from his nephew Lot. And friends, if you don't know the story about Abraham and Lot and all the rest of it, that's part of the reason we've given you the yellow sheets, to help you have a guide on what it's about. And you'll notice that one of the first assignments is to read through the chapters 11 to 25 of Genesis, and that'll help you know the story of Abraham. So next week when you come, you'll find it much easier to understand who Lot and Terah and all the rest are. He's just separated from Lot, chapter 13, verse 14. Does that give you time to find it? The Lord said to Abraham after Lot had parted from him, "Lift up your eyes from where you are and look north and south, east and west. All the land that you see I will give you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you." See, it's still the same promise, isn't it? A land, a people. But it's more specific now. It's this particular land, from what you can see there to there to there to there, that land is your land now. And how many people will you have? Well, look at the dust. That's how many people you'll have, more than you could possibly count. They are the people that will be your people. For a man who didn't have a child at all, that sounded fairly strange, I'll bet. All the more because his name, Abraham, meant exalted father, which for a childless man is an incredible embarrassment, I would think. The story is repeated. In chapter 15, it's covenanted, and there's an article in covenant on your yellow sheets which you can look up later as to what a covenant is. But in chapter 15, we get the great classic covenant of Abraham, where this verbal, oral statement of God in chapter 12 is actually legally set out in contract form, the contract of the ancient world. It's an interesting kind of contract, this one, where it's the one that was read to us earlier, where the animals are cut in half, and the presence of God, it would seem, passes between the animals, signifying that may it be done to me what has been done to these animals if I don't keep my side of the bargain. It's that kind of contract that is established. But it's firmly set out, and as it's firmly set out, more details are given too. Abraham, by this time, has adopted in a slave man called Eliezer, and he thinks that he will be his heir. And God says, no, Eliezer's not going to be your heir. You're going to have a son. Chapter 17, you find that the covenant, the contract, has now been confirmed to Abraham. More details are given again. This time, Abraham has had a son, Ishmael. It's some 13 or 14 years later, between chapters 15 and 17. Ishmael was the son of a slave woman, Hagar. And Abraham now thinks it's not Eliezer, it's going to be his own son Ishmael who will be the heir. And God says in chapter 17, no, it's not going to be Ishmael. You're going to have a son, but it's going to be through your wife, Sarah. She is going to have the son. And there's going to be further signs given at this time. There's the sign of circumcision, which seals Abraham as the member of the covenant, the other side of the party in the contract. His name is changed from Abram, which means exalted father, to Abraham, which means father of multitudes, from one degree of embarrassment to another degree of embarrassment. And it says that when you have a son, you're to call him Isaac, which means smiley. Because when anyone ever sees him, they're going to laugh. Well, if your parents were 99 when you were born, wouldn't everyone laugh at you too? That was exactly the situation. Everywhere he went, everyone called him smiley because he was such a joke. Fancy an old couple like that having a young son. But that is the one who is God's special chosen person to be the heir of Abraham, that joke called Isaac. And throughout this period of time, Abraham and God can appeal back to the contract as the basis of action. Now we do that, don't we? You buy a car, and in the car there is a warranty, there is a contract that they will fix up anything that breaks down in the first X number of kilometres or X number of months, and they'll fix it up freely at your expense. Now, that contract, you think, stands you in good stead, so that when you drive out of the shop and the back door falls off and the windscreen wipers don't work and a few other problems like that, you go back, contract in hand, and say, I want these fixed up, and I want them fixed up on the basis of this contract we have made. I wouldn't come to you, mob, except that you've got this contract, because I know you won't be able to fix it up properly. The only reason I go back to my dealer is because I've got a contract with him that he will fix it up. Now, God makes the contract with Abraham. And God, in chapter 18, says, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, but I've made a contract with Abraham to teach him righteousness and that he will teach his people righteousness, so I'm going to show him what will happen to Sodom and Gomorrah because I've made a contract with him. Or Abraham, when he is going to send out his servant to find a wife for Isaac, the servant's got to go and just find a wife somewhere, but she's got to be just the right girl. Now, how do you go and find a wife somewhere and it's got to be just the right girl? Abraham says, don't worry about it. I know you'll be able to do it. How? Because God has promised to my descendants. Isaac must have a wife because we're going to have descendants. So I'm sure God will lead you to the right one. You find it in Genesis 24. It's because of the contract that I'll be able to do it. Genesis 24, verse 6. 24:6. Make sure, says Abraham to his servant, make sure that you do not take my son back there, because the Lord God of heaven, who brought me out of my father's household and my native land, and who spoke to me and promised me on earth, saying, to your offspring I will give this land, he will send his angel before you so that you can get a wife for my son from there. See, he's quite sure that you shouldn't send Isaac back home to Ur or Haran, to Mesopotamia. Shouldn't send him back there because this is the land of promise. And somehow God will be able to do it because God has promised my son this land. Therefore, don't go off elsewhere. You see, he's got the contract, and on the basis of the contract, he lives. And he works out what he should do and where he should go and how he should do it. And God does the same. Ultimately, the contract is a personal relationship or an expression of a personal relationship. Any contract is that. Some, like the one with my car dealer, is a relationship of total distrust on both sides. That is why it is spelt out in such careful details and in such minute print. Other contracts, like marriage, are an expression of affection on both sides. This is an expression of faithfulness on both sides. God will be true to his word. He is a faithful God. Abraham is called upon to have faith in God, to be true to the covenant. But it is a relationship, and it's spelt out beautifully in chapter 17, verses 17 and 18. There's a marvellous statement of it there, where it says, God says, I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant. So it's a permanent, fixed contract, this one, between me and you and your descendants after you, for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. The whole land of Canaan, where you are now an alien, I will give as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God. The contract is an expression of the fact that this is the God of Abraham, and Abraham and his people are the people of God. And from here on in, the Lord of heaven and earth is happy to be called the God of Abraham, for that is who he is. That is the one who made the universe. He is the God of Abraham and Abraham's people. And Abraham and Abraham's people are the people of God from here on in, for the rest of time. That little passage, chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, is deceptively simple. Just three quick sentences, a couple of promises, and we're flashing on into exciting stories. But do not be deceived by it. It is crucial to the whole Bible, because that is where God chooses his man to be his people for all time. And if you want to relate to God, it will have to do with relating to Abraham, because it is to Abraham's people that God is God. And it is through Abraham that all the other nations of the world are blessed. And it is through Abraham that people are cursed. A fire engine with one of those big snorkel ladders. My son would never let one pass without me giving an adequate description. It is Abraham becomes in human history the key man. Now, how do we find all this fulfilled? Where is the contract completed and fulfilled? Where do the promises come true? It was a question that hung seemingly over Abraham's head. Stop. This is a great sermon because it falls bang in two parts. And therefore, if anyone wanted to stand up so as to allow circulation to take place in certain areas of their anatomy and then sit down, they could do it, because it wouldn't disturb the flow of the logic. So if you wanted to do that, you'd have to act quickly. Mind you, don't enjoy yourselves while you're doing it, but I just thought you might like to, at that moment, have that brief. Enjoy yourselves. It was the question that hung over Abram's head all his life. Where is the fulfillment? How does it come true? God's made these tremendous promises. He's going to give me a great nation. I haven't even got a kid. I then find one. He says, no, not that one. I then have one. He says, no, not that one. How is it going to happen? Where is it going to be fulfilled? But it's a question that not only hangs over the life of Abraham, it hangs over the life of the whole Bible. And it's how you perceive the contract being fulfilled today will determine whether you're Jewish or Muslim or Christian. And of course, if you don't believe in the contract, it's because you're atheist. Now, or some other religion it may be. Now, where is the contract fulfilled? In the next 2 weeks, we'll be looking at this in much greater detail. And we'll be looking in particular at who is the true son, or who are the true sons of Abraham, next week. The week after, we'll be looking at how do the blessings of Abraham flow across to the other nations, to other people. How do they benefit from Abraham? And so while we're looking at the whole contract tonight, we will keep in mind the land promise in particular. Well, was the contract fulfilled in Abraham's lifetime? And the answer to that is yes and no. Yes, he received the sons, Ishmael, Isaac, and through his second wife, Keturah, he received six more sons. So he had a little bit of a tribe going at that stage of the game, up to eight. It's a handful, especially as most of them are 100 years younger than you. Yes, it's fulfilled in that he lived and died in Canaan, the land that had been promised to him. He was buried in Canaan, his own land. Yes, it came true in his life in that he brought blessing to the nations around about him, to his neighbours. Those who liked him benefited, and those who attacked him found difficulties. So, it's true. But no, it's not true. It didn't really come true in Abraham's life, because he didn't bring a blessing to all the families of the earth, hardly anything like it. And he lived and died in Canaan, yes, but he didn't have ownership of the whole Middle East, as is promised to him. And certainly he had 8 sons, but that's not quite as many as the dust on the ground or the stars in the heaven as he was promised. I mean, at the end of his lifetime, he's not a mighty nation, he doesn't own the land, and he's not a blessing to all the nations of the world either. He died and lived the same way, in obscurity, except for the promises of God. The only part of Canaan he owned, which is a very telling illustration for modern man, was his grave. It's the only bit of property he actually ever purchased in Canaan. His wife's grave and his grave, which he shared with her. So in Abraham, no, it didn't come true. But then again, it's for his descendants. And so possibly it's in Israel that we expect it to come true. Surely the sons of Abraham, through the heir Isaac, received the promise. Yes, that's true, they did. And no, that's not true, they haven't. Yeah, the time of, say, David and Solomon. There they are, a mighty nation, huge in numbers and great in importance. And under David, it said that they owned the land from Egypt right through to the Tigris-Euphrates. The whole Middle East was theirs. And wealth in abundance. And they brought peace and prosperity to all their neighbours around about them. The story of Sheba coming up to see Solomon wasn't a love affair, even though modern movie makers may make it that. I've had to say modern movie makers. I actually wanted to say Cecil B. DeMille, but I'm told that no one knows who he is these days. But those of you who can remember those things, I'm sure Cecil B. DeMille would have... Through the heir Isaac received the promise. Yes, that's true, they did. And no, that's not true, they haven't. Yeah, the time of, say, David and Solomon. There they are, a mighty nation, huge in numbers and great in importance. And under David, it said that they owned the land from Egypt right through to the Tigris-Euphrates. The whole Middle East was theirs. And wealth in abundance. And they brought peace and prosperity to all their neighbours around about them. The story of Sheba coming up to see Solomon wasn't a love affair, even though modern movie makers may make it that. I've had to say modern movie makers. I actually wanted to say Cecil B. DeMille, but I'm told that no one knows who he is these days. But those of you who can remember those things, I'm sure Cecil B. DeMille would have made a Sheba story. And it'll all be about a love story. It's nothing to do with that. Sheba came from the end of the earth, because that's where Sheba was to them. She came up, the queen, from there so as to see the wisdom and the wealth and the might of the great King Solomon. For he brought blessings to all the nations of the earth. And so under a David and Solomon, it looked like the promises had come true. But it didn't last. They were soon decimated, the kingdom divided. And then they were destroyed. The 10 of the 12 northern tribes were destroyed by the Assyrians, never to be heard of again. The 2 southern tribes were destroyed by the Babylonians and kept in captivity and slavery for 70 years. And when they reconstituted the nation Israel, a pitiful little state it was at that stage, it was overrun by the Syrians and then by the Greeks and then by the Romans.
together with the Seleucids and the Ptolemies between them all. And then after that, of course, the Roman Empire, as it collapsed, you find one nation, one empire after another runs over that country, so that Israel is never Israel until maybe it's 1948, when you get a modern state and you can see the importance of that for Zionism. For it's when we come back to our land, maybe now we are being the people of Abraham. We know we're the people of Abraham. We're getting the promises of the land that's always been promised to the people of Abraham. Here it is, but what has happened to all the generations between? The thousands of years when people did not live in the land. Are they the sons of Abraham? Is that true? Not all Israelites are the true sons of God, of Abraham. For not all Israelites worship the God of Abraham. Not all Israelites believe in the God of Abraham. Indeed, there are many Israelites today who don't even believe that there was an Abraham, let alone be the sons of Abraham. It is a strange and sad thing, for they are not the true sons of Israel, the sons of Abraham. The New Testament takes a different tack altogether. It says you find fulfillment of the Abraham promise in Jesus. He is the true offspring of Abraham. And it's in Jesus that we find the promise coming true of the land, of the people, and of the blessing. For it is in Jesus that all the nations find blessing. It is in Jesus that all manner of men and women become the children of Abraham. And Abraham becomes the father of a multitude of nations. It is in Jesus that people come into that permanent contract with God where he is their God and they are his people. But you say, Philip, I get all that. That's no great problem. But what about the land? And the New Testament says that it is in Jesus that we receive the land, the promised land of heaven itself. The land that Abraham looked for, says the New Testament, was not Canaan. It was heaven. The lesson we had from Hebrews chapter 11, it'd be helpful, I'm sure, if you turned it up at this point, Hebrews chapter 11, makes exactly that point. Anyone got an NIV page number for me? 279 in the New Testament section. Hebrews 11 and verse 13. All these people, that is Abraham, Sarah and the like, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, and they admitted that they were aliens and strangers in the land or on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have opportunity to return to it. So Abraham, you see, called himself an alien in the land. And when you call yourself an alien, when you call yourself a sojourner, when you call yourself a traveller through, then the question is, well, where's your homeland? What is the homeland for which you are looking? It can't be Ur. It can't be Haran. It can't be Mesopotamia, because they could have gone back there. No, no, the homeland they were looking for is different, says the author of the Epistle of the Hebrews, verse 16. Instead, they were looking for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. The New Testament sees that the promised land is not Canaan at all. The promised land is heaven. Hebrews chapter 4 and Galatians chapter 4 will give you parallels to that on quite different topics, but make the same point. That the promised land is of a different character at all. That God, in showing them Canaan, was trying to illustrate heaven itself. And that he is really not primarily concerned with the Middle East. That is, when you find the fulfillment of the promises of Abraham in Jesus, then you come to a very radical conclusion. Radical as far as Zionism is concerned, because you say, the land you seek to live in, and for which the world is at war, it would seem, is ultimately not got to do with the promises of God to Abraham. And you, if you do not love the Lord Jesus, are not the sons of Abraham. It's radical for many people who profess to be Christians and who seek to find the fulfillment of prophecies of the Old Testament in what has happened in the restitution of the state of Israel. And there are many books like that, although not on our bookshelf, I'm glad to say. There are many books like that, which I take it are completely wrong. They've missed the point. That in Jesus you find the fulfillment, not in modern Palestine. That is not where it is at. They want the promises of Abraham, and for that they are to be commended. But if we're to understand how they are to be fulfilled, then we must understand what Jesus does to them. The hardest one to understand is the land. But the critical one to understand is the descendants. Who are the true descendants of Abraham? Are you a son or daughter of Abraham? Once you've established that, whether it is those who are in Christ or those of physical descent, or those of descent through Ishmael and on into the Islamic world, once you've established who are the true children of Israel, then other ways in which these promises are fulfilled will become clear, and that's what we must turn to next week. However, let me at least make this much conclusion so far in our inquiry about Abraham. That it is of great importance for us that we see the fulfillment of these promises to us, both in terms of becoming God's people, as God had always planned to have a people, being taken to God's country, as God has always planned to have his people living in his country, in order that we may become the great blessing to all the nations around about us. Part of God's plan from the beginning is not just to have his people, but through his people to bring blessing to others. You see how by the third week we'll come to evangelism with a great thump. You want to ask questions or make comments about what's been said so far? I warned you, it's not easy, this stuff, but it's very important. Yes, David?
The whole point of the scriptures is that God's promises are fulfilled in Christ. And you mentioned, say, books interpreting Zionist political events as being false. Is that a similar way that we understand the ration books on the whole sort of thing about current political events moving into the world? Because what the Bible says.
David has raised a point, which I am glad and happy that he has, for it gives me opportunity to elaborate. It's like this, he said, he has rightly picked up what I have said, that as the promises have their fulfillment in Jesus, so to find the fulfillment outside of Jesus in terms of modern Zionism or in terms of the restitution of Israel and the like, is to miss the point of what the Bible is about. If that is the case, says David, does that mean then to find the fulfillment of prophecies in modern political goings-on, would that also be misleading and actually a wrong interpretation? That's the question, isn't it? Yes, most definitely. So that's where Herbert W. Armstrong, Garnet Ted Armstrong, in the heretical class, and then also in a less heretical class like late great Planet Earth, Hal Lindsey, they're all way off the beam. So the Jehovah's Witnesses go wrong, and the Seventh-day Adventists, and you name it, group after group. Get the biblical prophecies and the biblical promises and look around today. Gog, well now that's somewhere up in the north, we'll call them Russia. Magog, they're somewhere over in the north also, we'll call them Poland. So anything you get about Gog and Magog in the Bible has got to do with the solidarity movement in Poland, and away you go in marvellous flights of fancy. If you want to understand the Bible, the best way to do it is to find out how the Bible understands itself. And the prophecies and the promises of God in the Old Testament find their fulfillment in the New Testament. And the New Testament says they find their fulfillment in Jesus. Indeed, one verse is so bold as to say that all the prophecies and all the promises of God find their yes in Jesus. every one of them must be rooted back into Jesus. Now, of course, Christianity might be untrue. Jesus might be a great hoax and all the rest of it. If that is the case, we'll go looking and see if you can find the prophecies elsewhere. But the magnificence of Christianity, the magnificence of the New Testament, one of them, is the way in which it gets all the loose strands of the Old Testament, quite disparate strands that you wouldn't think, promises that you don't think would have anything to do with each other, and ties them into a magnificent knot right on the cross at Calvary, when suddenly all of it makes sense. It all comes together there in a radical yet thoroughly satisfying fashion. That's the things we've got to be looking at in the next couple of weeks, you see. This week's the hardest of the lot because we've got to start looking at what those promises are about. But I want to foreshadow the direction in which I'm going to take it. That's it, in Jesus. Yeah, Bruce? That verse is 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 20, I think. If you can look it up, we'll check it if I'm wrong on that. Is it misleading then to look at the book of Revelation and jump off from there into this is what's happening today? For better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, and sickness and in health, it is my intention, God willing, to expound the book of Revelation on the campus at uni this year. George Bernard Shaw said that there's very little difference between a brave man and a fool. And I keep bearing that in mind as I prepare. He also said the man who leads the cavalry charge is the man who's lost control of his horse. Which has got nothing to do with the price of eggs, but it's too good a line to miss, and I don't know when to use it. Now, yeah, that whole method of interpretation of Revelation, I'm sure, is wrong. I'm sure the book of Revelation must be found first and foremost in its own historical context, rather than in ours. And I have discovered in verse 3 of the book of Revelation, if I've done that much preparation at least already, is it verse 3? No, it's verse 1, isn't it? Verse 1, it's the third line. I was going to expound it in a place, and I found out I can't because the third line, I'm already in trouble. It actually says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. And the word soon is quite an emphatic little Greek word. It's not talking about the far distant future, it's talking about the soon. Now, if I was writing to you a letter and said, look, I'm going to tell you what's soon going to take place, I don't think you would expect I meant 2,000 years later. I'm sure it's about John and his day that we must find the understanding of the book of Revelation, rather than today. Once you move to that position, of course, the whole book of Revelation gets turned inside out. Let me put it another way. You know, amongst Christians, there are great divisions about what you do with the book of Revelation. If you want to cause a fight, expound the book of Revelation. Now, I believe that the real fight does not take place in the book of Revelation. It actually takes place at Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. That if you've understood the topic sentence of the Bible correctly, which is Genesis chapter 12, verse 1 to 3, if you didn't know that, if you've understood that properly, then you will know where the book of Revelation is heading. But if you haven't tied the book of Revelation in right back to Abraham and that promises and the covenants, then you'll be off the beam on the book of Revelation. That the real division between Christians on the book of Revelation is made before you've reached verse 1 of chapter 1 of Revelation. Because it depends on what you see as the plan of God for the whole of the world. I mean, what I'm trying to do, friends, tonight, is we're building a massive house during the whole ministry here. Tonight is the digging the foundations and laying down the very foundation stones of what it's all about. Now, foundation stones are boring to look at, unless you're a civil engineer, and then you find fascination in all kinds of strange things. But foundation stones are boring things. I mean, big deal. And you look at them and you say, well, I can't work out if that's going to be a two-story or a three-story house. What's in a foundation stone? But, of course, the foundation stones determine the house that's going to be built upon them. Determines whether it'll be able to stand or not. Determines the structure and shape that it will take. I mean, there's no more important bit than the foundation stone, although it's hard work being bothered about that bit.
And it's because most people don't bother with foundation stones like Genesis 12, 1 to 3, that they run amok at the book of Revelation. And so that's why, although it's hard, Yakka, I've gone back to that this year to start off there, so that we can all be on in tune with what God's great plan for the world is. Stephen? Stephen raises the point, is it fair to call him an insignificant nobody when he is called a mighty prince by his neighbours, and when he has 318 soldiers to help him defeat some kings, etc.? Yeah, I think it still is. Sure, there were nobodies who are nobodies more than Abraham, like he had 318 servants. I presume servants are less bodies than masters, although I really don't, coming from such a good, strong working class background. But sure, he's a man of some property, but of minor property. The fact that they call him Mighty Prince, I think, is just an ancient Oriental politeness. I don't think he can actually hang anything on it. In fact, his whole regiment lasted 318 men. It's not really a mighty prince when the others are actually kings of cities. I mean, he wasn't a pauper. He lived very comfortably as a nomad. He hung around the cities. He wasn't actually out in the desert. That's why he didn't have camels very much. He had a few, but camels were not his trade, because he wasn't a Bedouin out in the desert. He was a shepherd, but he didn't own the land. He just wandered from pasture to pasture with a great caravan and 318 servants and their wives and kids, and he had some possessions. But in the ancient world, there were hundreds and hundreds of people doing that. And in this particular time in history, there was great mass migrations of nomads all across the Fertile Crescent from the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. I've got to do it backwards for you, haven't I? From the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, up through the valley, across the top of the desert, it would say, the north part of the desert, down the Middle East, and straight through down to Egypt. And in that whole territory, there was just a movement of people going from pastures to pastures, and one group, one little tribal group, was Abraham and his family. And so nobody, I don't expect anybody will record him other than the Bible writers. Whereas some of these other people have been recorded because they actually own cities. Yeah, Graham. Graham points out that in the Genesis account, it sounds like Canaan is what is meant, that they are looking for. Whereas in Hebrews, it makes the point that that's not what they were looking for. How can that be? Well, part of the key to that lies next week on who are the sons of Abraham and how it's being fulfilled. So I don't want to steal all the thunder for next week, and I haven't prepared next week's fully yet either. But that's part of where the answer comes, so you come for the next exciting instalment. Part of it lies, though, in that while they're promised Canaan, they don't set to and occupy it. They don't buy it except for the funeral site. And Abraham calls himself in chapter, where he makes the negotiations with the Hittites about the funeral site. The only time he comes to buy it is, I've forgotten the chapter number, 23, when he negotiates with the Hittites to buy the land. That's the only time which he actually purchases or sets out to fulfil the promise, it would seem. But in that chapter, he calls himself an alien and a stranger in this land. Now, if that's his homeland, why does he call himself an alien? Why doesn't he say, this is my homeland? I just don't own it yet, but it is my homeland. This is where I'm heading to. And the author of the Hebrews does what is a very Jewish rabbinic piece of argument. He says, you see, he doesn't call it his homeland because it's not. He was looking for another homeland.
Now, whether that's the truth of the argument, whether that argument will hold water or not, you need to do when you do studies on Hebrews. But that is the line that will be taken, and you'll see how Hebrews comes to that conclusion when you've worked out who are the true sons of Abraham. Which will have to be next week, so why don't we sing a hymn about it, shall we? There, the last hymn is a ripper. It's about the only hymn I can think of that mentions Abraham. It's number 2.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.